Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This project is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
This week, we're talking with Dr. Bettina Schmidt of the School of Theology, Religious Studies and Islamic Studies at the University of Wales Trinity St. David in Lampeter. And she is also the honorary secretary of our sponsors, the BASR. Following on from our recent podcast with George Crusides, Dr. Schmidt wanted to share some of her experiences and the practicalities of doing anthropological fieldwork amongst practitioners of Condomblé, both in the Caribbean and in New York. Dr. Schmidt, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Why don't we start by describing your own fieldwork and the problems you found?
Well, I did my first fieldwork on religious studies for my PhD thesis in the island of Puerto Rico in the Caribbean. I went to Puerto Rico the first time. I had an idea about research about women and religious healing on the island, but soon I discovered that this topic really does not work when I spoke with people. So I think a typical aspect of fieldwork is that it changes topics. You start with one, but then because you're in the field, you develop a new approach to the topic or even a new topic. So I came then back after my first visit in the Caribbean, spoke with my supervisor and told him, oh, sorry, but I changed my topic. It will be about religions. I found access to Santeria, which is a Cuban religion practiced by Puerto Ricans on the island, and Spiritism, the Puerto Rican version of a popular form of Spiritism, and then focused on ethnicity, identity, in connection with the two religions. And so a typical problem doing fieldwork is that we have to respond to the people we speak with and the field. I think it's not possible to be prepared just by reading about religion or culture or society. We have to be there, we have to get into the field, and then we are developing new topics. This is a typical anthropological approach. I know that other people approach research differently, but for an anthropologist, this is quite typical.
And I imagine we spoke to George Crusides yesterday about the insider-outsider problem. Mm-hmm. This must be a big issue in anthropological fieldwork.
Yes, in particular, but also in my first fieldwork in Puerto Rico, Santeria is organized in different religious community houses, temples, or they call it Casa de Santo, the house of a saint. I got access, I could interview the priest, but it was difficult for me to attend ceremonies. Spiritism was even worse, because when I arrived on the island, Spiritism, was a bit underground. I found in the archive, in the museum, in the library and university, a lot of material about the importance of Spiritism from the turn of the century, 1920. But at the beginning, no one wanted to talk with me about Spiritism because it had a negative image. Pentecostalism became, since the 1960s, quite dominant on Puerto Rico. And this reflected a bit on the public image of Spiritism speaking with the dead. And so later on, during my PhD time, I visited New York City because New York City University has a very good archive, Center for Puerto Rican Studies. And there I described my difficulties speaking with people. And one colleague there immediately took the phone, called his aunt, he was Puerto Rican, his aunt living in near the university, near Rio Piedras, on Puerto Rico, and told her, oh, here's a German anthropologist. She would like to speak with you about Spiritism. couple of weeks later, I flew again to Puerto Rico, stayed in her house for a couple of weeks, and this helped me to become introduced to other spiritists who were absolutely willing to speak with me about it, and I attended ceremonies. But I needed this personal introduction to get access to the rich field of spiritism.
And when you're doing this kind of field work, I'm interested in how you data gather. Mm-hmm. Are you simply there observing and taking part, and then later on you codify it and write it down? Or are you, while you're working, already sort of codifying it and recording it, and how?
Yeah. Well, it was, in all my research, is quite different. In Puerto Rico, I could stay on the island just for a couple of months and then had to return the following year because I was teaching assistant at that time and financed my PhD by teaching during the semester. So I started reading about it. I went, of course, to the archive and in Puerto Rico in the National Library and interviewed people and tried to observe ceremonies. And interviewing, I normally tried to record them. Some people didn't like to be recorded, and so I then made notes in my notebook. When I attended ceremonies in Puerto Rico, it was the case that people didn't like that I took photos during the ceremonies.
Yeah.
So what I then did directly afterwards, I sat down with my notebook and wrote down all the different steps and stages of the ceremony I observed. And not only date and description, but also whether it was hot, whether it was smelly, or how the people interacted while I was there. And so I tried to make notes immediately. My recent research in Brazil was very different. In most ceremonies, they had no problems that I took photos. At the beginning, I was a bit shy. In my first ceremony, I think I took photos only when I noticed other people took photos. Mm. But then I got wonderful photos of people being possessed, because people had no problems with taking photos. Not in all ceremonies, but in some. So suddenly I have now quite a rich teaching material, because I can show photos via PowerPoint. Also in Brazil, because it's much more open to speak about speaking with the dead or being possessed by deities, people had no problems at all that I recorded interviews. And because it was done, of course, in Portuguese. And my Portuguese is a bit rusty, my Spanish is better. So I asked then at the end some graduate students to transcribe my interviews in Portuguese so that I had all the transcription with me. Sometimes during ceremonies, I also took out my recorder just to record the music, the drums, the noise, to remind me later on when I'm at home about the atmosphere of the ceremony, because it then helped me to remember how I felt during the ceremony. And so I sometimes record music, but normally I record ceremonies. But again, immediately afterwards, I sat down and describe the whole process. And so it's a bit different. And another research I conducted in New York City, there I was able to observe more ceremonies than I was able to observe in Puerto Rico. And I was quite lucky at the beginning. A colleague who was anthropologist of music, and who had done already work on music in voodoo in the Haitian religion. She took me to a ceremony, and then she explained some of the stages to me throughout the ceremony. And this helped me to recognize and identify certain aspects. Later on, because the ceremonies are quite similar, later on I also was able to recognize certain stages. But this friend of mine, she helped me by explaining some of the stages. It was really nice.
I imagine in these kind of researches that a problem would be how to phrase it, the difference between the everyday form and practice and the more elite form. So you're talking a lot about ceremonies, but I imagine observing the same people when they're not in ceremonial mode is an important part of understanding the relationship between the religion and the culture. And which also begs the question about whether, when you're as a researcher, whether they're putting on their best face and presenting themselves as they wish to be seen rather than as they are.
I think this happens sometimes in interviews, that they describe certain things because they think I want to hear them. The ceremonies I attended were always ceremonies not for me. I was just allowed to attend the ceremonies. And so they didn't stage it for me. But sometimes in interviews, so I have to be careful how to use some of the information in the interviews, try to check it with by interviewing another person and see whether the information are similar. And so this happens. But in Puerto Rico, in New York, I started more and more looking into spirit possession and the whole idea of possession. During my PhD research on Puerto Rico, I ignored the fact. I just mentioned in my PhD thesis that this happens, but I'm not commenting on it because I can't say either or. But in New York, though, again, it was not my topic at that time, I also, the entry, in particular in the voodoo group in New York, for me, were musicians, the drummers, who also give workshops, and so they have classes. And often I met them in the class, and then they invited me to go with them to a ceremony following weekend. But one group in particular, they also perform on stage, because they also have a band, group. And in one ceremony, one weekend, I went to a ceremony in Voodoo Temple in Long Island. A couple of weeks later, the priestess who... more or less the main character in this possession in Long Island was on stage, because she helped this friend, this musician, in the presentation of some dancers and a fake ceremony on a stage of a theater. And this was for me also quite interesting, to see the different practices, the different body movement, because it was a stage. They don't want public possession. It has to be in a ceremonial house so that the person who is possessed is protected. And so they prevent any possession on stage. It's always faked, therefore.
That's interesting that they're faking something that they ostensibly do for real in private. It's interesting.
And the music is the same. In Santeria in Cuba, one of the great old Cuban anthropologists, Fernando Ortiz, who started writing about Afro-Cuba and Afro-Cuban tradition and so on, he also bought a couple of drums and put them in a museum. However, I was told that because they were not ceremonial drums, they just look as if they are ceremonial drums, but they were not sacred drums, and so not really ceremonial drums.
And do you ever represent your the work that you do amongst these groups back to members of the groups? And I wondered if you had, and what their response was.
Yeah. Well, in Puerto Rico, of course, my work on Puerto Rico was in a PhD thesis published in German. So though I've sent copies back, they could just identify the photos, but not the text. However, I always afterwards, I started then publishing in Spanish and in English, so that they could see what I was doing with the material. In Brazil, my newest project, some of the priests I spoke with are quite sophisticated members of the Brazilian society, and so they read English, not only Portuguese. And so they already told me that they are, will be really interested in seeing my articles as soon as they are out. And I will send them back, of course. In New York, I sent, I published the New York book also in English, first in German and then in English, and sent it also to some members back, and the response was positive. But let's see, I have not been back in New York, and so I just have now email communication with them.
Okay. Another question would be to do with the ethics and things mm-hmm. in research, one being anonymity. There was a presentation at Edinburgh a while back from someone who was working with pimps and doing research with pimps, and the standard procedure is to anonymize your narrative and things, but most of her informants were adamant that they did not want to be anonymized, and they mm-hmm. wanted it to be their voice. Just wondering if anything like that, anything ethical has come up, and what could potentially come up, and how you negotiate those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think this is an absolutely important issue, the way how we use the data afterwards. I always try to discuss with them whether I can use the name or not. Or say at the beginning, I will not use the name unless they want to. And it's sometimes different. In New York, I also interviewed and attended ceremonies of a proper church. But they also conduct some other ceremonies, and so it was from Trinity in Tobago, so it was a Baptist church, but sometimes they had other ceremonies, and then they closed the doors. So I was invited, but it was made clear at the beginning I'm not allowed to take photos of this part of the ceremony. In New York is the problem with animal sacrifice, because all of Caribbean tradition, they're also in some ceremonies, they need blood, and so it's they sacrifice animals. And United States allowed since the 1980s the ritual sacrifice of animals, but under certain conditions. And often small communities can't fulfill the conditions. And so this is why I was told when a white person enters or comes to a ceremony, they are a bit afraid whether this is an officer from the immigration office or animal protection group. Mm-hmm. And this is why I was told they need always introduction, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to attend. Mm-hmm. Brazil, there is not this problem. It's animal sacrifice is possible in the ceremony. However, the Pentecostal churches in Brazil started in the 1990s a holy war against Afro-Brazilian religions. And in one publication, the leader of the church put in a lot of pictures from sacrificed animals and rituals. This caused quite a lot of negative uproar, and so they also don't want the sacrifice is photographed. Mm. So only part of the ceremony, the public part, is possible to take photos, not the other parts. Mm. However, I was able to attend some of initiation rituals. This was for me very good. And so at the beginning, I spoke with the priest, and he told me that I'm allowed to take photos at the beginning from everyone, and then later on at the public ceremony, but not in between. And so what I saw during the next days, I describe, but I don't have photos. Mm. So I always try to protect the anonymity of the people, but sometimes they want to become public because they want to attract new members or become more famous. Mm. So sometimes they want the name published.
Going back to, again, George Casillas, not that we're wanting to do this in every single one, but we were talking about Insider Outsider, mm-hmm. and how much of your anthropological work is participant observation, And when you do participant observation, how do you judge whether you're reporting your experience or the experience of everyone else who's there?
Mm-hmm, yeah. I think ethnographic studies always present the material from the perspective of the anthropologist. I cannot describe something from a different perspective because it's always me speaking and seeing and hearing and smelling. So I always have to bring in also my own response. In New York and also in Brazil, people ask me, when I ask questions about how does it feel to become possessed, or you have to be initiated, you have to step in. And when I, one house I was then working in the kitchen and cleaning up the dishes, and they said, oh, this is the first step to become initiated, to do the ordinary work. But I always kept my distance. I don't want to become so much involved in the religions. And so I'm, at the end, always outsider. But I try, with the interviews, to get them to present me their own insider position. And then in my publication, I try to present their view by bringing in quotation from the interviews, for instance. Mm. So I'm always the outsider, but sensible.
In anthropology, earlier anthropology was a big problem, but it's difficult not to bring in your own theoretical assumptions when you're taking part in this kind of research. Is it a situation, obviously it's much better nowadays, but is it a situation that we can ever actually get round? Is there a way of being completely objective in these kind of situations?
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I don't think so, that it's possible to be absolutely objective. When one of the reviews of my New York book, the reviewer mentioned that apparently throughout the book I mentioned 5 times that I was fascinated by it, and she criticized it. And I thought, why? It's my own perspective. I was really fascinated by the ceremonies, and so it was my own emotion what I tried to describe, not in a negative or positive way, just emotion. And I think this is what anthropologists have to do, bring in their own perspective, but try to do it not in an offensive way. In my current project in Brazil on possession and trance, the problem is with the term. Spirit possession is considered nowadays a bit negative. So people don't like to use the term possession. In one interview, took me 5 minutes to get the medium to describe what he's doing because I always use the wrong term. He said, oh, there is no possession in his community. But he explained me that he wrote several books under the influence of the spirits. And so it took me a while to get to the correct term. I think this is also where I try to bring in a kind of objectivity, but embrace the discourse of the people themselves, how they speak about it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schmidt.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we were speaking there with Dr. Bettina Schmidt of the University of Wales Trinity St David in Lampeter in what is the last of our interviews to have been recorded at the BASR annual conference in Durham last year. Now, later this week, Chris and I will be travelling to Chester to take part in the SOCREL, Sociology of Religion annual conference, where we'll be recording more interviews which we'll be broadcasting throughout the end of the year and into the next. We'd like to hear from you if you enjoyed last week's collaborative podcast on the future of religious studies and our own roundtable response to it. These are formats we're interested in pursuing in the future, but we want to know if it's something that our audience wants to hear. If you have anything to share with the Religious Studies Project, please leave a comment on the website, or you can post links, videos and anything else on our Facebook page. If you're one of the people who's done this already, or one of the people who's given us a ratings on iTunes, or somebody who's retweeted one of our posts, then thank you so much. But we'd really, really like more people to get involved, telling us what you think, giving us additional information. We'd really like for the Religious Studies Project to become a real hub for discussion about religious studies on all levels. Next week is an interview that Chris recorded with Marcus Davidson at last year's EASR conference on fiction-based religion. Marcus is following up on a lot of the points raised in Carol Cusack's podcast from earlier in the year, and Invented Religions, and taking some of the discussions a little bit further. So we hope you'll join us for that. And as always, thanks for listening.